Okay, now everybody's in from the outside. I'd like to welcome our speaker for this evening, Sharon B. from Los Angeles.
Hi, I'm Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank Leslie for asking me here. It's nice to be asked back. That's happened to me in sobriety, and it still fascinates me that I am asked back, because there was a time in my life when I people were glad to see me leave the state, and it's not like that today. I was thinking of my day, which has been one of those full moon days, I guess. I woke up earlier than normal and decided to have some quiet time. And that worked for about 10 minutes until my son got up. He's 5, and he wakes up with a smile on his face and, you know, spring in his step, and he's healthy. It's like, I still don't wake up like that. And we went to his school, and I met with two of the sisters, because I opened my mouth when I took my son to that school. I said, where's the playground equipment? And they didn't have any. So it's like, if you don't want to make the coffee at an AA meeting, don't complain about the coffee at an AA meeting. So they assigned me playground equipment, Mom. So I've been working on that for a while. Now, this is a long ways to go from the drunk that walked into Alcoholics Anonymous on August 20th, 1975. There's no way that two sisters of the cloth sit me down in their office and want my opinion and want my direction and want my energy. And the weirdest thing of all of that is I sponsor one of them. So, and then I took my 33 bunnies that we sold for, that was the playground equipment money drive, off to my law firm and passed bunnies out all day long. And it's just, my life amazes me. I was driving down here tonight about 79 miles an hour or so. I have a cause, right? That's what I was going to tell the officer, too. I'm having a cause. But we got here, and things worked out, and it, you know, it amazes me when I go to bed at night, just how much life I've lived. Boy, there was a time that, you know, I would have 2 days off between my shifts at the Lamplighter where I worked, which was a local joint down in the French Quarter in New Orleans. And I had probably already drank a quart and a half of tequila while I worked the shift. Then I would go for my 2 days off, and I'd start at my favorite bar, the Bastille, which is one of those bars where you didn't know if it was day or night until they cracked the door, and then everybody hit the deck. I mean, it was like we were vampires there. It was, but I would spend 2 days there, and maybe one of the whole days that I was there, what I would do, when I would pass out, I would pass out there on the bar. They would watch my purse, put it underneath, because I was protected. And I would come to, I would have another drink or two. Maybe I would throw up. I certainly wouldn't order any food. I certainly wouldn't care if it was day or night out. I certainly wouldn't care who was sitting next to me. I just wanted that tequila to work some more. I would pass back out and maybe come to, maybe that evening when the party was already going on around me. But that was what I did. That was what alcoholism did for me at the end of my drinking. That's all I did. Now, to get from there to an incredibly full life where I can look in the mirror and say, you're okay, I can like myself, I can respect my life, I have people in my life that want to be in my life, there's no way. And I am of service to the world today. I've always wanted to be part of the force for good, and I think Alcoholics Anonymous is one of those biggest forces. The world is definitely a better place tonight because we're sitting in here sober than out there doing our thing. So you are part of that force for good, too, by sitting in here tonight sober. I grew up in Iowa, and it wasn't where I would have picked. There's a few fellow Iowans, ex-Iowans, in this room tonight, but I've made peace with being from there. But when I drank out and I was in another state, I was always from Wisconsin. I was too embarrassed to be from Iowa because it was, you know, they always called us the potato state, and then I'd have to correct them, and then they would say, oh, the pig state, and then you know, then I would certainly show them what a pig was all about if I was drinking. And but I was embarrassed to be who I was, living in my own skin, growing up where I was growing up, in the small town I was growing up in. There was never enough for me. There was just not enough there. Now I have two normal sisters, a normal brother. My parents still live in the very same house I grew up in. They're so normal, when they moved the highway, they moved the house. They didn't build a new house. They moved the whole house a mile and a half down the road. So, I mean, they still live in the same house. They're married 48 years. I am the only alcoholic in that family. They all grew up and they have great lives without going through all the mental and physical and emotional gymnastics I had to go through to get to where I am today in life. But I do not blame my alcoholism on my family, the Catholic Church, growing up in America, love it or leave it, none of that stuff, you know. But when I was 18, 19 years old, full-blown alcoholic, had already tried, thought I was going to get married. I found out that, well, he was seeing his tutor on the side more than just studying. I found that out, so I gave up getting married. I thought that God was very unjust and unfair, and so I gave up God. I went to college to be a teacher, and I thought that there was, you know, that they were living in another century, so I decided to be an artist, and a free spirit, and alcoholism and drug abuse went along with that. I was full-blown alcoholic living in New York City by now. I had been to college a couple of years. I had given up a lot of my ideals. I had given up a lot of my dreams already. And at 19, I was already, you know, alcohol was more important than anything else going on in my life. I was living in a city where you could drink at 18 years old. You could drink day and night. I had a job where they liked to drink two-hour lunches. I had a job where they would take care of you if you had a hangover. And I didn't want to be in advertising. It was just paying for my fun. I was on some sort of a search to fill that hole inside of me that was as wide as the Grand Canyon, because it would seem like briefly I could fill that hole. Briefly it would happen. There would be moments where I would feel like I was on top of the world, and alcohol filled me up from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes, and I stood taller than anybody in the room. You know, and my aura was white, and I felt great. And alcohol transformed my life for me. Alcohol allowed me to be somebody that I wasn't when I was sober. Are they even? My falsies, we used to put them here, now we put them up here. God, I'm blushing. Now, I mean, if you know parts of my story, and to be blushing, that's a spiritual awakening. It's wonderful that women, as used up as we are, come here and we become innocent again. I don't know where it's written, but I've read it about the innocence of life, and that happens here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But alcohol, I followed that road straight downhill happily for a long time, because it was the only thing that, you know, that rolled my nylons down. It was the only thing that did anything for me on a consistent basis. And then when I stuck it with geographics, it was even better. I would move in the middle of the night if I liked your idea, if things were cooking right, if you, you know, whatever you had was more than what I had, or it was what I wanted, I moved. And I ended up at a commune in Huntington Beach after I was a cowboy in Colorado. You know, it's a long story, but the bottom line is that something would come along and it would look better than what I had, so I went with it. And it didn't matter if it was, you know, far away and I didn't really know who you were, I went with it. I was a very free spirit. I was also one of those peace and love generations that I would give you the peace sign with one hand, but I would give you the finger with the other hand. I mean, I was never real good at it. I didn't quite fit in there either, because I was just too angry. So I ended up at home at 21 again with my mother and my father, and by then the relationship with my father was over. There was no more little girl, there was no more dad, there was just a lot of hurt feelings, a lot of angry things. I did a lot to hurt my father, but my cry is, I'm not hurting anybody but myself. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. And I really beat my chest on that one. And after you get sober and you get a sponsor and they push you through those steps, whether you want to or not, you get to something called the amends step. And they put 8 and 9 down there after we start delving into ourselves and looking at our character defects and start cleaning our own house and get honest. And when I finally got to the amends step of Alcoholics Anonymous, I saw how much I had hurt my father. I saw how much I did to my family. It wasn't true that I was only hurting myself, but that's the disease, alcoholism. Very selfish, self-centered disease, you know. I want to get mine right now, and I don't care who it's going to hurt or what it's going to do to anybody else. It's just got to, it's got to happen for me now. Me first, you never. And my father and I weren't speaking, and I went to see the family priest, and I really got honest with him. I got a lecture, you know. The guy had no warning what was coming, I think. He was not in tune with alcoholism, and I left that confessional that day feeling, you know, there is no God. Nobody understands and nobody cares. They sent me to some psychiatrists, and I don't talk to psychiatrists because he's getting paid, not me. Let him figure it out. The family doctor didn't treat my non-functional gallbladder. He just looked at me all bloated and puffed up and said it was my nerves and gave me Valium and sent me on my way. Nobody knew what was going on in my life. See, I'm 21 years old. I'm from a nice family. I have an okay IQ. I don't know how high it was, but people told me that I had a lot of potential. School was always very easy for me. I usually got what I wanted when it came to that kind of thing. I could always hold myself up socially, and now I'm 21 years old and I'm starting to really fall apart, and nobody could sense alcoholism or spot it, or even if they asked the right questions, you know we lie. I did. And so things were bad that winter. My dog died. I remember my dog Tar Baby, the one that they had given me at the commune in Huntington Beach. I thought I really made out good. I came to Huntington Beach with $2. I left 4 months later with $5 and a dog. I did great, you know. I didn't have one dry day when I was here, and I didn't work. We just had a lot of spiritual experiences. So Tar Baby got killed that winter. I remember that. And she got hit by, it was a Greyhound bus, and I was real drunk, and I was out calling her. And of course, I never look up the road to see what's coming down. And she was coming, and she was coming as the Greyhound bus was coming, and so she was frozen, flat as a pancake. And I put her in the trunk of the car, because you can't bury a dog in the winter in Iowa. So I would go to these little taverns, and I'd get really drunk, and I'd be really lonely, and I'd open the trunk of the car and look at her with a flashlight and cry. Because she was frozen in there for a couple months. And that's something, you know. You guys are laughing because you identify. That's what you're doing. You know, but that's something that I felt really bad about. You know, I felt really bad about that. And that's something you don't tell the guy next to you in the bar, because that's not tough, or that's not independent, or that's not, you know. It's just something that you, one of those seedy little things you put and you bury. They feel bad about it. Every time you see a dog, you feel bad about. You know, that's not something that you sit around with people I work with today, and because we're telling parts of our past, I don't tell about the Tar Baby story. I mean, you just don't do that kind of thing. But I can come in here and you're laughing. That was the first thing that got me in Alcoholics Anonymous, was the sick humor laughter we had here, you know. And I think laughter and tears are very close for me. They're very healing, both of them. But anyway, I met him, and he took me to northern Wisconsin, and he was into health and organic stuff, and he made me organic, and he thought that was going to fix me, and I didn't get better, so they took me to the hospital, and they took out my gallbladder, and they said I had pancreatitis, and I said, I'm 21, I shouldn't have this. What's wrong? Do you drink alcohol? Do you take drugs, you know? I'm not going to tell them about all the hundreds and hundreds of trips of LSD I was on, because that was last year, you know, and alcohol, he had taken it away from me, and all we were doing was smoking organic marijuana. And so I said, no, doctor, you know? So they took this out, and I started to feel better, and my life continued in a very boring fashion, because he had taken away my alcohol, and he put me to work is what he did. If you're up in northern Wisconsin on an organic farm, and you heat and you cook with wood, you work. You tap maple trees, you know, you do a lot, there's a lot of work. You make your own bread, you grind your own wheat, you do it all, you know, and I was too busy to worry about it. But there would be this itch that would come up on me occasionally that I would start to get thirsty. And his little bottles of organic dandelion wine just weren't cutting it. And the night I remember, and I hope I remember it till the day I die, was the night that it was the second snowfall, and the first one we were snowed in for 2 days. We couldn't get out. So I knew this was going to be another heavy one, and we were going to be there for a couple of days because we lived out in the woods, and the snowplow didn't hit us right away. And I'm looking at the snow, and the snow's starting to look really heavy, and Phil is in the corner learning to play his banjo, which he never did learn to play the banjo, but he was over there trying with his, learn to play the banjo with Pete Seeger on the phonograph. It was a phonograph, too. It wasn't a stereo. So he would pick it up again and start at the beginning of how you go bum titty with this banjo, and he would get stuck in the titty somewhere and he'd pick it up and start it over and over again, you know. And that's irritating enough, but when he's going along with it and he's missing the notes and the cat, I remember the cat was just, its tail was going as the rocker was going, you know. The dog was frothing at the mouth, its tongue started to hang, you know. And Phil just, you know, it's like one of those where the room looks long and Phil is kind of like fading into the corner, and I just said, I'll be right back. I jumped in the car before it got too bad. I got 2 cheap gallons of wine at the general store, and I came home. And, you know, the snow didn't look so heavy anymore, and Pete Seeger would cross the room, and the Rolling Stones went out and on, and the cat was smiling, and the dog was smiling, and I was smiling. And that alcohol felt so good, and I drank it all, and he woke up and looked at me from the room, and it gave me that look that my mother had given me, any well-meaning people in my life had given me, counselors had given me, you know, the Hare Krishnas had given me, those people that spot me, you know, the Scientologists, my sisters, the priest, psychiatrist, that look of what is wrong with you, you know, that look of there's just something different about you. Why don't you live up to all those that potential you've got, you know? And I wanted to tell him, I don't think I have it. You don't understand, you know? I don't have those other 2 cylinders to fire up you keep talking about, you know? Why can't you just smoke these? And he would throw the organic pot at me, you know? And my head said, alcohol's more fun than you, Phil. You know, my head made a decision that alcohol was, I was going to marry alcohol before I was going to marry Phil. And I knew it that night. And that was November, and it took me until I think it was June to get rid of him. But we're persistent, you know. And when he left in June, he left me with a half acre of marijuana, which I thought was class. We had planted. And it grew to 12 feet tall, and I harvested it by myself, well, with the horse and my dog, and 3 days we did that. And we did it right with the wood stove, and you boil it, the plants, there's a whole theory. There's books out on how to harvest your pot right. And so for 3 days I was drunk and loaded, straight, and that's all I did was just do this pot stuff. And I had to drive into a town called Menominee, 45 miles away, with this pot to turn the dope deal because I wanted to get out of town. It was late August and winter was coming, and I wasn't going to be up there in that uninsulated schoolhouse alone chopping wood. So I went to turn this dope deal, and what happened was I forgot the dope that night. I left it back in the farm. I just forgot it. It was the main ingredient in my life, but I was having too much fun. So I joined the carnival because it was there. I did a lot of things in my life back then because it was there. Some of them I won't tell you, but I didn't have any... you know, when you have a night like many of the nights I had where you throw up and you lay in your own vomit for a while, you kind of come to, you throw down some more shots of tequila, you get going, you go to a new party, you meet new Mr. Him, you end up in a situation where you get a black eye, you finally make it home half in and half out your door, you know. When that happens to a normal person, that type of situation attaches to something in them, like, don't do that again. But me, in my alcoholism and my disease, if you're like me, that attaches to nothing, absolutely nothing. And I did those type of things over and over and over again. And I didn't learn from any of it. There was nothing to learn. Alcohol was my fix. It had become my life. With the carnival, I ended up in Bogalusa, busted for drugs. I spent 31 days in maximum security with my new boyfriend. Well, he was in with the guys, I was in with the girls. But we went to jail, they let us out, and I found the French Quarter, and that's where the next 3 years I became a full-blown 24-hour drunk. I mean, you can't stay falling down happy drunk or any of that drunk all the time, but I drank breakfast, I drank lunch, I drank dinner, I drank midnight, I drank. I didn't even know that my life had progressed to that point. That's how powerful alcoholism is. Cunning, baffling, powerful. I didn't know, because I surrounded myself with people that did the same exact thing. I worked in the bars, I lived in the bars, I lived in the French Quarter, I lived above bars. I didn't, you know, pay a light bill and, you know, I didn't pay a phone bill. I didn't do that type of stuff. I didn't go to the laundromat. I didn't make beds. I didn't go to the grocery store and decide what I was going to eat for the week. I didn't do any of those normal things. My life was in the bar. That's where it was. It was in the bottle of Jose Cuervo Gold. And when I discovered Jose Cuervo Gold, I didn't need men anymore because Jose kickstarted me. It was like starting a Harley. Just pour that stuff down and I would get moving. I got sicker and sicker. My parents came to visit me at some point down there. I'm not even sure when, because we haven't talked about that visit yet, and I don't think it's necessary to bring that back up out of their memory. But they came and found me living above a bar, living with my boyfriend from the carnival. It was 2 years of abuse, you know. He'd give me a black eye, I'd wait for him to pass out, I'd give him a black eye. We had a very equal relationship. And we had a skunk, we had a snake, we had my dog, we had filth, we had, you know, this is where they found number two daughter, who was the one that, you know, the one with the biggest smile, the one that could make the room light up when she was smaller, the one that had the hopes and dreams to be a United Nations translator. This is what they found me living in, and how they found me living. Now, they didn't know alcoholism. They didn't know what was wrong with me, and neither did I. When they left that day, I knew that if I went with him, it wouldn't change. And I think that they left me there. Maybe they didn't know where I was going to be or if they would hear from me. You know, the phone rings at 4 a.m. I don't have to do that to my mom anymore. I don't have to call her at 3 or 4, or, you know, odd times of the day or night, wish a Merry Christmas 2 days late. Miss her birthday by a week. My mother doesn't panic now when I call. My mother doesn't hide her voice on the phone from my father. My parents can sleep at night, and I'm so grateful because the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given them a peaceful life, and they deserve that. They deserve that. I kept ending up in Southern California. A friend of mine who I was with was shot and killed feet away from me by the New Orleans police, Mardi Gras Day, the last Mardi Gras that I drank, which was in 1975. And I should have been standing there right with him that day, but I happened to be 2 feet inside the door. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I used to be graced to sit in a room with a speaker called Norm Alpe. And he used to talk about seconds and inches, and what a gift it is that we're in here tonight, that a lot of alcoholics never get this far. A lot of them are sitting at home in their bedroom, and they don't even know about Alcoholics Anonymous with the vodka under the bed. A lot of them are out in the street, too far gone to even know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, that we are very lucky that we didn't knock our head on a table and have a brain hemorrhage, kill somebody in a drunk driving accident, and kill ourselves. We are very lucky that we're sitting in this room tonight. It's by seconds and inches in the grace of God, and I knew what he meant. I knew what he meant. I kept ending up in Barney's Beanery in Southern California. I would leave here and go, and I became unemployable in the French Quarter of New Orleans. I became unemployable in Southern California. Nobody wanted me to be a cocktail waitress. That's how my head couldn't even remember a table of drinks. I was 170 pounds of alcoholic bloat, and I didn't eat. You know, I just puffed up. I was so toxic and so sick that I had splotches on my cheeks, and I'm sure that my eyes were yellow. I didn't look at myself anymore. I didn't bathe. I didn't even know I was going to sleep a lot of the time. And I was sitting in the bar one night, and a couple of guys on Harleys needed some weight on the bike, so they called the fat one out, and I got to go out to Palm Springs. That was the only reason I was invited, because they needed some weight on the back of their tire to go to the desert that night. It was windy. So they dropped me off at a nightclub and promptly left, and I met two new guys that took me somewhere that night. And that night I hit the jackpot. That night is important for me because that night I was surrendered, to the point where I had no more ideas. And I'm lying there after my jaw broken in three places and my nose was mashed pretty flat. I've got pictures of it. I had been raped, I had been drug around in the cement, and I had been rolled off of the road outside of Palm Springs at 6:30 in the morning to lie there without any clothes on, in the sand, face down where nobody could see me as they drove by, and bleed to death. I had been left there in the hot sun. And what happened that morning was something inside of me said, "Get up, I want to live." Now that wasn't my voice, because somewhere during the course of that night, I stopped screaming, I stopped caring. Something inside of me just said, okay, fine, I don't want to live. And that next morning, something inside of me happened that I choose to call my God. I choose to call divine intervention, because it wasn't my idea to get up and get some help. It wasn't my idea to walk down this road with no clothes on and find somebody's condominium and try to get the people up, and a gardener ended up finding me passed out by the pool in a lawn chair. It wasn't my idea to do that. Seconds and inches that I'm standing here tonight, I really believe that. The police came, I ended up being the victim in the town, it made the news. They didn't want it happening there, they were all around me, and I knew something else. I knew it wasn't their fault. Now, it had been your fault that I was in the situation I was in, sitting in those bars with no self-worth, no ideas that mattered anymore, no goals, no excitement for living life, I would put down that rock glass of tequila and sometimes it would make me warm and most of the time it wouldn't. Most of the time I knew in my head that I was just no good, you know, that I wasn't enough, that all those things I had done I'll never be forgiven for, and I had no answers. But that morning I heard truth again, and the truth said it's not their fault, and it's not your father's fault, and it's not the way you were raised or all those things, that you're lying here on a gurney going into surgery. It's not their fault that you're here. It's your fault. You did this to you, and I heard that. Now, I wasn't capable of being honest with myself, because between me and me is justification, a ton of it. And I don't know where that thought came from. I like to call it divine intervention. I like to call it being plucked from the abyss, right to the edge where I could look over and the hand of God took me by the collar and pulled me back. I didn't run out and join AA. I laid in the hospital for 2 weeks, but some situations happened where I ended up living above a liquor store. I ended up having no answers, no place to go. I was, of course, unemployable. I had to go back to court. They caught these guys. I had to go back for doctors. I was tired, and I was living above a liquor store, and I was drinking red wine, and there was no more magic, there was no more warmth in the wine, there was no more, this is alcohol, fill me up. There wasn't there anymore. And he said I had to leave the guy that I was staying with, and I called my mother. And it was August 20th, it was a hot August day, and my mother said, "Sharon, I can't help you anymore, why don't you go to the Salvation Army?" And this was my mother in Iowa releasing me. And if my mother would have sent me $20, I know you'd have another speaker. See, that's seconds and inches again. You know, I was forced to turn left when I wanted to turn right. Mom said no. And I called a girl that I had met in that bar, Barney's Beanery, and she read my mail. She knew alcoholism because she had been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. She was the only person in my life I had ever seen with the big book up until that time, and it was in the bar and she was drunk. So that was my first big book. But Chris got me to somebody who was sober, because Chris wasn't sober then, and I didn't know I was calling a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. All I knew was that this woman would help me. And I called Suzanne, and Suzanne read my mail. She told me not to drink anything, don't smoke anything, sit down and wait, and these two girls are going to come get you. And within a half hour, there were two women there. I sat outside on the steps because I didn't want her to come upstairs. I was embarrassed. I felt totally, I mean, I didn't know who was strangers were coming to get me, to take me where. I had no idea. I had no idea that I was coming to where I belonged, finally. And these two girls popped out of this Volkswagen with their bright smiles and their blonde hair and their bright eyes and all of their yammering at once. And, you know, they were coming at me like this and happy to see me. And I mean, you know, it's a wet one. I mean, God, one was 2 years sober, one was 1 year sober. They were like so excited to have this 12-step call their sponsor had given them. And they stuck me in the back of the Volkswagen. I mean, I had no choice. I just had absolutely no choice. And then I couldn't get out, and it was, I remember I was so claustrophobic, and there were no windows that rolled down in the back, and I was sitting on that little hump in the back, and they would turn around and tell me parts of their story all the time. At every red light, they just, you know, Debbie turn around, and Diana turn around, and they would just like, They took me to a meeting where the Pacific Group met. I didn't know it was the Pacific Group. I didn't know it was an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I didn't know anything. But I have a loving God, and I ended up where I belong. See, I belong here. I'm not just a member. I belong here. And that feels so good. I didn't belong anywhere. We're a bunch of people that just didn't belong anywhere, and we belong here. It's such a nice feeling to know when I walk in. Something happens when I walk into Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just like, oh, the pressure's off momentarily. It's like, you know, when I used to first take a drink, you know, when it used to hit bottom, it was like, oh, the pressure's off. Alcoholics Anonymous works the same way for me, you know? It just takes the pressure off so I can go back out there in the world I don't understand for another 24 hours. And I didn't feel that immediately, but I felt something going on in this room. It was probably half this size. They sat me in the front of the tables. They didn't let me get away with not raising my hand. I didn't know what it meant. I wasn't even listening. They raised my hand, you know? I didn't know how they all knew I was new. This old man with the 20 questions came up and handed to me and said, take them, and I took them, you know, and I passed with 17, and he was just so happy. I mean, I didn't know why he was happy. I didn't know why they were laughing. I didn't know what was going on here. I kept waiting for them to bring me down the aisle and sprinkle holy water on me or something. I mean, I kept waiting for this forever routine that happened at all these other places I had been to and tried. And there was no forever routine here. There was this phrase called a day at a time. And I went, oh, I've been doing that for a while, living a day at a time. I think I can handle this. And for about 2 weeks, I didn't know I was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea where I was coming. They just dropped me off and picked me up and dropped me off and picked me up. And my mouth was wired shut for the first 3 months I was here, so my ears opened. And I heard a lot of stuff. And I was teachable. See, that was the key ingredient for me, for my surrender, was to be teachable. I was not teachable. I had all the answers and none of the answers, and what you were going to give me didn't matter anyway because I didn't deserve it. You know, I was not coming from a full deck. There were a lot of short circuits happening inside of me. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they went, oh, let us do it for a while till you can do it for yourself. And then when I started to feel guilty about them doing it for me, whether it was giving me change for cigarettes, giving me clothes to wear, giving me a floor to sleep on, giving me a sleeping bag, giving me the big book, when I started to feel guilty about that, they said, oh, cut it out, kid. You can do it for somebody else when you get your life in order. That's the way we want you to pay us back. Just pass it along. And I like that. I kind of like that. Because, see, I'm a scorekeeper. You do it for me, I do it for you. You know? Hi, Cindy. And my life got better because I got a sponsor, and my sponsor moved me to her couch, and that was a spiritual awakening right there. I mean, that said a lot for sponsorship. So if you're new, get a sponsor and see if your life changes. And I moved on this couch, and I started to realize that I was, you know, 30 days sober. That was impossible for me. I started to realize that maybe I should stay here for a while, as that old-timer told me, to take off my pack and stay with us for 30 days. And then he said, no, you look tired, kid. Stay with us for 90 days. And I thought, well, he's smart. I am tired. I don't know how he knows, but I know that I'm tired. And I ended up moving to a little $24 a week room, getting a waitress job. They took the wires off. The court case went fine. My life started finally. It started very simply at 26 years old. I went to a lot of meetings. I got a lot of commitments. I met my husband-to-be, and we just rolled through Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. And I was in this big group that was, we did panels, we did conventions, we did, you know, I did a lot of stuff. I kept on the move. I had a sponsor because I found out that they can work. I didn't find that out right away, but she was half Mexican and half Indian, and she was louder than me. She dressed louder than me. She used to wear non-matching clothes. She used to wear fancy wild socks and these wild things on her neck and these wild things in her hair, and none of it ever matched. It was just like I wanted to go home and redress her all the time. But she was short, you know, and I could always find her in a room. I mean, if I couldn't find her up here, I'd look down there. I could always find her with the feet, you know, with the crazy socks and shoes. And sometimes I wouldn't see her at a meeting, but she had this laugh that embarrassed me. It sounded like a duck. She'd quack, 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 quack. And I'd be sitting in the front of the room and you know, like mad she wasn't there because I had to share with her what happened today, how I went out there and I really turned it over and I faked it until I felt it and all of that stuff. And what happened was I heard her laugh from the back of the room and I felt better. I just felt better. I felt like there was somebody on my side and somebody that understood. And boy, all my life, nobody understood me. But you don't understand. But you don't understand. But you don't understand. And I came here and you started to understand. I could see that you had been where I had been and your life was better. And that's called hope. I finally got some hope. By watching you and coming around the same group and watching your life change and watching my peers, people that had come in with me, watch their life change and get better and believe that it could happen to me too. I worked the first 5 steps in my first year because that's what we did then. you know, you work, to me, working step one was raising my hands for 30 days and admitting my life was unmanageable and getting a sponsor. So that was how simply it was put to me, and that's how simply I did it. Step two to me was brought to my attention that I better get a God or I'm going to get drunk, and that was by my sponsor with her finger in my face one night. So that's when I picked my first higher power, which was Beacon's moving van, and because it drove by right at that moment. So I picked it, and she didn't care. I thought it would make her mad, but she said, good, it's not you. I don't care. Just pray to Beacons, and I did. And I wake up in the morning, and I have this little Beacons truck they gave me in Iowa sitting on my dresser, and I look at it every morning, and I know what it means. I'm out there in the world at various places at various times, whether it's on the freeway in L.A. or in Houston, Texas, frothing at the mouth about something, and I see a Beacons truck, and I immediately feel better. Because I know that I'm not alone and I'm not running the show. And thank God I'm not. Because see, I have a loving God today, a God that loves me more than me, a God that's got much greater, wider realm of answers than I can come up with. You know, sponsorship and sponsoring people and being in the middle of that kind of removes those blinders a little bit. It lets me out of myself. It lets me into your life. It lets me see if I can be of service and I forget about my problems. And it's not so bad. It's not so bad. It's a privilege to be a sponsor. It's a privilege to have one and to call one on the phone. I feel real safe by knowing that I got one and I give it, you know? I feel real safe there in the middle. And I like feeling safe. I worked step three with her on my knees, and you know, she put her arm around me, and then I thought that, you know, she was going to kiss me or something. I didn't know what was going to happen next, but nothing happened next. You know, I didn't turn gay. I didn't have a big spiritual experience. You know, I just took step three on my knees with her, and it's a wonderful prayer. I had enough big booms in my life already. I didn't need another one. And it just became a decision I made every morning. That I made, you know. And I did my fourth step because I was 11 months sober and ready to run and drink. And I got my first credit card, it was a MasterCard, and I went to the airport to call my sponsor goodbye and get on a plane. And I hadn't called her in a couple of days, and she was a little mad at me. So after she cooled down, I told her where I was off to. I was off to, I don't know, San Francisco to go have my slip. I was never a big Vegas person. I was going to go to San Francisco and have my slip. And she told me about one of her best friends named Stella, who went off and had her slip at 11 months of sobriety because she didn't want to finish her inventory either, and she burned up in a bed. And they had an AA funeral for her, but she didn't look very nice. And I didn't want to burn up in a bed. And she ticked me off, you know. I thought, where did she get this story, you know? They pull it out of the sponsor handbook or something. Stella's story, four step, you know? That's what I felt like she was telling me. But, you know, what happened was it motivated me. It made me upset. It made me angry. I thought, I'll show her. You know, I'm real good at, I'll show you. And I use that rebellion now for me instead of against me, you know. I use it to motivate me to, I'll show them, you know. And I went and I bought a book and I sat there, a notebook, and I sat there and I got over the hump of the fear of writing the fourth step. And it poured out. You know, I didn't finish it that night, but I got past all of the stuff that stopped that pencil all the time, that kept stopping that pencil. And I took my fifth step with her before my first birthday, and I took my first birthday cake, and I felt like I deserved it because I had done something that was very hard for me to do, which was lay your life out there, all of your guilt, all of your shame, all of those nitpicking little things, all of those dead dogs in the trunk, all of that stuff laid out there, and you share it with somebody else, and there's something that happens. It's a healing process. Didn't happen right away for me, but it happened slowly. And it starts from the inside. It's building that self-esteem. I had finished something that was so hard for me to do. I hadn't finished anything that magnificent and that magnanimous in years. Years. Maybe since I had learned to tie my shoes at 5. Maybe that was the last time I had done something that hard and really learned it. And I felt good about me, finally. And I came here with an empty glass. No self-worth in that glass, air. And all of those hard things that I've had to do, which are work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, go on a 12-step call when it's inconvenient, go to a meeting because somebody, you told them you were going to be there, go to the coffee shop afterward because somebody's having a hard time. You know, all of those steps and service things have put little eyedroppers of water in that glass. You know, one hard eyedropper, a hard day, boy. A spiritual day to me is when everything goes wrong, and I stay sober, and I'm still a good example because I'm staying sober, and I'm not taking out my 45 to blow half the world away. You know, I'm being a good example. I go to bed, and that's a spiritual day for me. Is when I have walked through a really tough day with the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get a whole eyedropper that day, a whole eyedropper of self-worth, good feelings about me. So that I have this glass that I built up over the years that's full. It's finally full. It took 7 years of sobriety to feel the love of God from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes with no big piece of metal slate in here stopping the feelings. I felt full, finally, at 7 years of sobriety. And that's that full glass that I worked really hard for with your help and your guidance and a lot of God, a lot of God's grace. So the next time I think about moving to Paris, France, where I want to become a street artist because it'll be different there. Or let's see, I never really drank in Florida. I think of that glass and I think of taking my hand and just knocking it off on the floor and letting it fly, and I have to start all over again. You know, that's precious to me. I worked hard for those feelings. If it would have come easily, easy come, easy go. That's the way I was. But when I have worked hard for a lot of the good feelings I have about myself, I think twice when I think of doing something self-destructive, letting the defect get so out of hand that it starts to deplete me inside. I like feeling close to my God. I really love it. It's something very, very special. It's something that, having had a spiritual awakening, is the result of these steps. Working the steps over and over and over again, I am full inside. I like that feeling. And so when I get a little bit off center now, I feel it, you know. Oh, I shouldn't have taken those pens from work, you know. I shouldn't have flipped off that little old lady on the freeway. I shouldn't have overspent on that credit card, you know, that kind of stuff. I'm not saying that I'm a good person. I'm not saying that. I am comfortable today. I had to take good and bad out of my vocabulary, and I had to shoot for comfort. Because if I'm good too long, I'm going to go be bad. So I'm shooting for comfort. And I like walking down the middle of the road with Alcoholics Anonymous. It has given me back my relationship with my family. I didn't tell you that my marriage fell apart at 10 years. At 5 years, I became a punk rocker, and I had to go to Al-Anon to learn how to release, not to reject. He came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. He had 15 years last month. He didn't have to drink. I didn't have to make him drink. I didn't have to drink. We found out that we liked to backpack together, and we found out that I got pregnant. We're doing that, I guess. Seed takes better at a higher altitude or something, I don't know. But I didn't know that I was capable of having that happen for me because I wasn't a big precaution taker. And I had never been pregnant. And Wesley was born on June 23rd, 1984. And happiest day of my life. Never knew I wanted to be a mom. I never knew I could be a mom. And he's five now, and it's full of energy and defiance and intelligence and creativity and good manipulator. He's a great manipulator. I look at him, I say, you don't know who you're trying to fool here, kid. Today we were at the grocery store after work, and he's like, I know what he's doing. He's by the candy, the loose candy, you know, and he tells me he likes the color of pink. Because he likes to draw. He likes this color pink, so he wants to sit here and look at this color pink for a while. And I just said, that's good, Wesley, that's good, but I know what you're up to. You know, we'll have some candy later, come on. And he sometimes looks at me like, how do you know, you know? And it's like, I'm going to have to stay sharp to stick with him. But he's in that Catholic school I was telling you about with that nun I sponsor that calls me a sensible, calm influence in her life. I can walk back in the Catholic Church and feel at peace there because I've made peace there. I've had my son baptized there. I got remarried there. Then he left 6 months later for a newcomer. I guess it didn't take for him, but that's his problem, I guess. But, you know, for a year we walked around the same meetings, not looking at one another, not getting in anybody's way. I go to Clancy's backyard and play volleyball. His ex-wife or his, oh, that's a Freudian slip. His wife stopped coming to play volleyball because I would smack the balls at her feet. And for a year we went through all of this stuff. And for 6 months he didn't see a son. And then he started coming around to see a son. And I couldn't be a good example of Alcoholics Anonymous and hold that child between us with anger. I had to let him go. And it was real painful to let him go all weekend with him, every other weekend. We went to court. I spent a lot of money fighting over record albums and nothing. But I was angry. And the attorney saw that, and we went to court a lot. Kept shelling out those big checks. Today I work for attorneys because I see they pay pretty good, so that's what I ended up learning from that. I learned from my lessons today. But 3 weeks ago we went to Daryl's birthday party, and Daryl is my ex-husband's son by his marriage with Jill. Jill, my stepwife, I like to call her. And I went to the party with Wesley, who's so excited about his brother, and I was taking pictures of their family, the four of them. I'd put Wesley in there, and then they'd take a picture of our little family, me and Wesley. And I mean, I'm in the kitchen pouring coffee, I'm lighting the birthday cake. I'll tell you, and I don't want to be married to him anymore. I want exactly what I have in my life today. But for a year, I didn't know that. For a year, I went on total blind faith. I believed that I was just in a hallway, that it wasn't the end of the world, and that God didn't really pull the rug out from under me, that there was something better on the other side of that next door. See, I'm an instant person. I like to drink tequila because it closed doors and opened doors right away. You know, there was no waiting. And in sobriety, I've learned that, you know, to enjoy the walk between the doors, because they don't always close and open. The job doesn't end, you get a new one the next day, you know? I don't know what God has in store for me, but if I stay in the middle of this and I try to be of service and work these principles, I get incredible stuff. I get stuff I never even dreamed I wanted that's more perfect than what I wanted. This is a real spiritual path here. And I need a cause. You know, I've always needed a cause. I like being part of the force for good. My father and I are very good friends today. I paid him back every dime I owed him, from the cars to the attorney to the bounce checks to this and that, for 3 years, one check at a time, with a note about my life. And at the end of the 3 years, he called me and wished me a Merry Christmas and said not to send him any more checks. That debt was clear. But he said, "Sharon, don't stop sending me your notes." And there was a healing that happened that day by working the amends step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my relationship with my father is wonderful. It's something I always wanted and never had. And I feel at peace when I go back to Iowa. I was sitting around there when I was there last summer with Wesley and my mom and my dad, and I had just shared at a convention 12 miles away in one of the towns I used to do a lot of damage in. And I got to go back and make amends and be an example. And we were having dinner, and it was one of those summer nights where the locusts are loud and the fireflies are out and the sunset is pretty and mom's got her good food on the table. And I was sitting there and something happened to me that I didn't expect. One of the gifts, one of those little healings. I finally felt a part of that family. And I'll tell you, Alcoholics Anonymous is a wonderful, wonderful way of life. I don't walk out of here and forget it. I take it with me. I try to be an example out there when nobody's looking, because I feel good about me that day, and I get another eyedropper full in that glass. So if you're new, I hope you get a sponsor. Don't drink and use between meetings. Keep coming back till you know what it's all about, and you too can have feelings about yourself you never thought were possible. That innocence, that self-respect. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you, Sharon. And now Don is going to read a vision for you.
Hi, I'm Don, and I'm an alcoholic. Okay, a vision for you. Our book is only meant to be suggested only. We realize we know only a little. God will disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who's still sick. The answers will come to you if your own house is in order. But you cannot transmit something that you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will pass to you and countless others. This is a great fact to us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand him. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you found and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us on the tragic road of happiness. May God be with you and keep you till then.
Okay, I want to thank Angel for reading chapter 3, Linda for reading chapter 5, and Jack for reading the 12 traditions, and we especially want to thank our speaker, Sharon, for sharing with us tonight. Michelle, have another round of applause. And thank you all for coming tonight, and you're cordially invited back next week when our meeting will be held by or led by another sober alcoholic who can read. And the speaker will be Clancy I from Los Angeles. And I'd like to call on George in the blue shirt to lead us in a closing prayer of his choice.